you know, and I wrote, I think in the fifth grade, I wrote a play about a wagon train. You know, I can't imagine what it was like a fifth grader writing a play, but you know, it didn't, it never got produced.
Lights, camera, action. Welcome to the Dunedin Film Festival podcast, the official podcast of the Dunedin International Film Festival. In each episode, we peel back the curtain to reveal the journey from script to screen. Join us as we dive deep into the craft of filmmaking, chatting with the visionaries who bring the stories to life. Whether you're a cinephile, an aspiring filmmaker, or just love a good behind-the-scenes story, you're in the right place. So grab your popcorn and settle in as we discover what makes the film world tick right here at the Dunedin International Film Festival. Today on the Dunedin Film Festival podcast, we have the pleasure of welcoming a true icon to the silver screen, a man whose career has spanned decades, leaving an indelible mark on the world of cinema. He is best known for his unforgettable portrayal of the formidable John Kreese in Karate Kid franchise and hit series Cobra Kai. Beyond the dojo, he's graced countless films and TV shows with his talent, showcasing his versatility across genres. But there's more to him than meets the eye. Off screen, he's a passionate advocate for the arts, dedicating his time and influence to bring more filmmaking opportunities to Florida, nurturing local talent, and boosting the state's presence in the industry. It's a mission that speaks to his commitment to the craft and the community of filmmaking. It is an honor to introduce the legendary Martin Cove. Marty, let's start from the beginning.
Yeah, actually, I think it started in the fourth grade, went to school in Brooklyn, New York, and elementary school, I did a play called The Golden Goose, which is pretty funny. And I just loved it, you know, and I wrote, I think in the fifth grade, I wrote a play about a wagon train. You know, I can't imagine what it was like a fifth grader writing a play, but you know, it never got produced, but I think I got it from all the TV shows I watched. Back then, you know, there were 35 Westerns on primetime television. Now that's a lot, especially when you have three channels, you know? And so you had channel 2, 4, and 7, which was ABC, CBS, and NBC. So, and they had 35 Westerns. So is it a raving decade for Westerns, the 60s? And I was influenced by all of that. And it was a fantasy world, and I came from, you know, parents who loved me a great deal, but they were not very imaginative. And they were, you know, depression era people. And so I was, you know, the only child, and I was out there by myself, you know, acting and carrying on and playing soldiers, and setting up forts and doing all this. And then I just took it into the real world of earning a living at it and going to class and learning, you know. And then I think Alan Arkin gave me a opportunity to do my first group of lines in a movie called Little Murders. And ultimately the scene was cut out, but he wrote me a letter telling me what a wonderful job I did. And he gave me, you know, great encouragement to move on. And up until recently, when he passed away, I would see him once a year and we'd laugh because I was somewhat established, you know. And when I worked for him, it was 1970, my first movie. And I was like, you know, whatever, but very unknown. And then, you know, you just forge ahead. And you, as I tell my son, tenacity is what every young actor has to have. You know, if they don't hire you, it's their mistake. And I've always believed in that. And there's a great show on television called The Offer, which is basically about the making of The Godfather. And it's all about Al Ruddy, the producer. And Al Ruddy just had obstacles left and right that you cannot imagine to prevent this movie from being made. And obstacles were Paramount. This is 1970, and they wanted everything to make as much money as Love Story. And they did not want Al Pacino. They didn't want Francis Ford Coppola. They wanted Robert Redford to play Michael Corleone. I mean, it was all these bizarre situations. And the cat just plowed through it, you know, and he made this movie called The Godfather. And not only was it a good movie, but it's classic. So I always tell young actors to really do watch this show and see the tenacious character of Al Ruddy to make some dream come true. That's about it. It goes up to the currency, tenacity.
That forward-thinking mindset that no today is not a no forever. And even when you do the work and you do an incredible scene, even if it does get cut from the production, it's not who you were as a performer. You showed up and you gave it your all. And it sounds like that's really what you have to do to make it in this business. Never give up and understand and know that the no's don't mean no forever.
Yeah, it's good. The no's don't mean no forever. All right. Yeah, and you just have to keep going, you know. After Cobra Kai is over, one will keep going. You know, I have this comic book that's turning into a Western. I'm turning into a series about a 12-year-old boy and me, an old gunfighter, and how they exchange moral values. And it's about heroes, you know, because I don't think kids today have any heroes. And the Marvel comic book scene is, you know, it's not as appreciated because anyway, those heroes were all special effects heroes. They didn't have the vulnerability that I think our heroes did from, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So that's what, you know, this project about, my legacy to leave something about heroes for these kids, you know.
I think you touch on something really important there. You know, going from a culture where we have 35 Westerns, where it's not superpowers, it's not super ammunition, it is these men that are fighting and advocating for the underdog and really coming in and being that pinnacle of strength that you want in a hero. Because when it's a superhero, you are like, well, I'm not from Krypton like Superman. I'm not bit by a spider like Spider-Man. And so how am I ever going to make a difference in this world? But focusing on the Westerns and those real heroes, a kid can see themselves as that person because that's a real person.
Yeah.
And so giving them that hero, that's how we can change that landscape back to that.
Yeah.
So you talked about, you know, Cobra Kai. When Cobra Kai's wrapped up, there'll be another project. So let's talk about that. You've played the same character for, you know, many years. And so what has that been like growing up with that character, with the series, and watching that develop?
Well, you know, I think we did. No one ever expected the Karate Kid to be as successful as it was. The gift that keeps giving 40 years later. When I signed on to do Cobra Kai, I had sat with the writers and I said, I'm not interested in doing John Kreese from the movie. You know, he's a monster and he's difficult. And I really want there to be some vulnerability written for this character. And are you up for it? And they said, yeah. And they you know, they managed to do it in flashbacks. And the character is somewhat of a controversial character and went to jail and he was framed in season 5, you know. But this now, which I can't talk much about, it's quite an interesting reversal they've got me doing. And, you know, he by the end of all the shows we're shooting a lot of shows, and he will be, you know, I can't really say, but he'll be really, audience will be very surprised at the growth of this character, you know, the maturation of this character, John Kreese, you know, and I hope they like it, you know, it's because I've always wanted to do things a little more vulnerable than that character. It just happens to be that character was in a movie that, you know, everybody looks at as a religion.
You know? Yes. That's quite the cult following.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always fascinating because you look at great movies that don't get this kind of run, like Lion of Winter with, you know, Katharine mm-hmm. Hepburn and Peter mm-hmm. O'Toole. Every other line is brilliant. Every other line is absolutely classic, you know. And yet, it's not the case in Karate Kid. You have a few lines, sweep the leg, you know, mercy's for the weak, you know, no mercy. But they mean so much to the kids for so long, and because it's played so many more times than the 1969 version of Lion in Winter, you know, they understand it. But for me, as an actor, you know, Lion in Winter is those kind of movies are just wonderful to remake. You know, you talk about remaking Cobra Kai from Karate Kid. I'd love to remake, you know, not too many of the Westerns, you know, Red River, Searchers, Wild Bunch. I don't think those are remakeable, you know. I really think it's like trying to redo Casablanca, you know. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? So I think that if you can actually, you know, recreate something that has a potential future as a remake, if you do it really well, it'd be fantastic, you know. I don't think you could ever do, I mean, they've tried to do Karate Kid, you know, in sequels, and they're okay, you know. But I remember Karate Kid 3. The vehicle was written for me. The whole vehicle was written for me. There wasn't a character called Terry Silver. There was no one there to put me on vacation and do everything I was supposed to do, train Mike Barnes, train Ralph Macchio all at the same time. I couldn't do it because I got a TV series. So all of a sudden, this vehicle written for me was now given to some new character called Terry Silver, who was ultimately 40 years later reoccurred on Cobra Kai. There wouldn't be a Terry Silver on Cobra Kai if I was available back in 1989 to do that Karate Kid 3. But it was bittersweet because it was a series that, you know, it didn't do well either one season, The Hard Time on Planet Earth. But, you know, it just goes on and on and on. You just live through all the surprises.
And that's the best thing about Hollywood is you're living through the surprises. You never know what's going to take off. You never know what the audience is going to resonate with and the hero they're going to see. And I think that is amazing that you've just ridden with this and you've seen what it can bring you. And even if you had to say no at times, it doesn't mean no forever, because then it became yes with Cobra Kai. So,
yeah. I think the film industry, certainly the film and television industry, there is no formula to what really works. You know, we're interviewing showrunners now for the Prodigal Son, the Western that I'm developing. And there really is no formula for why Barbie should make $1 billion across the world. I mean, I'm sure I haven't seen it yet, but it's not my cup of tea, but I will go see it because, you know, Greta did a good job of directing. Your average guy who's a little more macho won't go to see it. But it doesn't matter. It made $1 billion worldwide. And so there's obviously some merit to what she did and what the actors did. So, you know, there's no formula for anything. You could have a movie like, I remember, I wanted to be in it so badly, Going South. Going South was a movie with, was it Going South? Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson did a Western together with Arthur Penn directing. Now, this Arthur Penn directed Love Story, Little Big Man. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a Western that it was just before this. And you would think that was a foolproof combination. Jack Nicholson, Marlon Brando doing a Western with Arthur Penn, the guy who directed Love Story. Dreadful. And the movie went no place. It was called Missouri Breaks. It was called Missouri Breaks. And I love watching Brando. I love watching Jack Nicholson, you know, but the movie wasn't very good, you know. And you'd think, why wasn't it any good? You had great actors and good story and good director. And it just probably their egos didn't work because they knew each other. They lived, they don't live far from each other. But who knows? Things don't work in certain areas and you cannot conceive of them in that direction. When you think you have all the elements that are perfect, the right elements in a movie don't necessarily constitute success. You know, that's the challenge of it all.
No, you can never fully cover the spread. And that's the big thing with it.
No.
So thinking about the magic and the formula that it takes to make a movie, when you think about making a movie here in Florida and especially Dunedin and A Taste of Love, which is what you're here promoting at the Dunedin International Film Festival, it sounds like a pretty good formula here that you have. You got a beautiful location, talented performers, amazing town that's embraced you guys. Tell me what it was like to film here in Dunedin.
Well, you know, the producer called me up who had done, you know, we go to the Hole in the Wall ride where Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid used to hide out. So it's a place in Casey, Wyoming. And every year we go out for 5 days in chaps and dusters and we live out the Western heritage. And so this fellow was a producer. He did Rough Riders. He did lots of movies. I worked with him before, named Lincoln Logason. And he said, come and play. And I said, well, I'm moving to Nashville. And he says, no, just give it 2 weeks. And so I went, I came down here, and it was just, it was lovely. It really was lovely. And the people were so nice. And at that time, I had a relationship with them. My ex-girlfriend, Mary, and she lived in Clearwater. So it was really nice to have her there, like part as an extra, you know. And everything was sweet town. Everybody was so kind. Stayed at the Fenway, which I'm at now, and I love it. Same room. I got the same room, you know. And I think it's just a sweet town, and I like the energy here. And I certainly, you know, living in Nashville right now, what I really miss is the warm weather, but most importantly, the beach.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Spending all those years in California, I'm used to being able to drive to Santa Monica or Malibu, see some water and beach. You know, you can't do that in Nashville. You know,
no.
Here you got it. You know, so it's lovely. You know, it's really lovely. Maybe I should have looked at some horse country in Ocala. I should have looked there, you know, instead of strictly Nashville. But in short, this state has great potential because we shot this Western in December in Parrish, Florida, in an old Western town. And this fellow built this old town, and it was fantastic. And it was like right out of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It was like all the wood. It's as if what was were put together yesterday in the cabin, and they didn't have time to shear off the bark. It was just, it was so rustic and human and real that, you know, it was a great town to make this movie. And the movie stars my son Jesse, and I just, you know, I have a co-starring role in it. But the bottom line was, it's about making a deal with the devil, and it's very well written. And it's really well shot.
Well, I'm excited to see it. I know that I get a little taste, a little teaser of it. And so I cannot wait to see that and see where that movie goes and everything that you guys are doing here in Florida. It sounds like definitely filmmaking in Florida is not making a deal with the devil. And it sounds like almost, you know, paradise to film out here. And I'm so excited that you're bringing that recognition. You and Jesse are working hard for people to see the opportunity to film in Florida. So. Let's talk a little bit more about the fun sides of what you do. Some time through COVID, you started doing a podcast with your kids, Kicking It with the Coves. What was that like? How was that experience for you?
Well, Kicking It with the Coves was a podcast for an organization in Los Angeles. And Podcast One, I think, was called. And they wanted to have Cobra Kai guests all the time. So we had everybody from Cobra Kai on, and eventually we wanted to diversify and have coaches from different teams, college teams in Los Angeles, and they had different who had different points of view about teaching the students versus my character in Cobra Kai, John Kreese, and talking about it, you know, really seeing what works, what doesn't in real current events. And so my daughter would bring, you know, psychologists and all that in. And somehow the people there didn't really want that. They wanted celebrities only and nonsense, you know. So we just, after about 15 shows, we kind of stopped. But the kids were great. It was so good to see, I have twins, and it's so good to see both of them just devil may care and as articulate as possible, spewing information that I didn't even know they possessed. And like radio commentators, like Walter Cronkite. My kids were like, Walter Cronkite. And I was so proud because they were articulate, factual, and very gregarious and not at all concerned or shy about being on the radio.
Which is a very unique style of performing. You know, radio performing and just communicating in this way is a very different than film and stage acting. So I bet that did make your heart really proud to be able to see your kids in this way and be a part of something unique and special with them.
Yes.
So I love that. Wonderful. So I like to ask all the guests today on the show, you know, we talk about a meet cute and screenwriting and, you know, when characters meet and this spark is born. So when would you say that that moment was for you with filmmaking? When was that spark of this is what I need to do for the rest of my life?
It's an interesting question because there are so many projects that. Well, I think it was early on, you know, fourth, fifth grade. And I never did much about my scholastic life, you know. I don't know if I went to school down here, you know, and did a lot of partying. But I would say when I did The White Buffalo with Charles Bronson, I mean, he was really one of my idols at the time. This is 1976. And I played Jack McCall, the man in history who kills Wild Bill Hickok 4 years later. And it was just a scene at the bar. And it, oddly enough, also got cut out. Other things I did in the movie didn't. But the interesting thing with Charlie Bronson was I would chat with him, and he didn't want to chat with anybody. But I never came on to him. You know, I didn't say, sign this picture, sign that picture. I would bring in these 8x10s from different movies he did. Magnificent Seven, you know, When Hell Broke Loose, a couple of others, and I would show him the pictures. I never would ask him to sign them. 8x10s, they were, you know, production shots. And he says, well, I was real ugly here. I said, you aren't ugly, Charlie. And we had a great conversation. So he really liked it. And when we finished the movie, because the movie was written well and it was good, I just, in the same, the director was the man who directed a movie that I loved as a kid, The Guns of Navarone with Gregory Peck and Anthony Quinn. This movie was made in 61. But this director, J. Lee Thompson, he directed Taras Bulba, which was a movie about, with Yul Brynner, about the Cossacks. And, you know, he was a formidable director. And so I was, I loved working with him. But I gave Charlie, when we wrapped, those old gunfighter books that, you know, those brown books that Time Life put out at one time, Gunfighters, Great Chiefs, Railroads. And I gave him the gunfighter issue. And I took a picture that we had taken at the bar. And it was a really good photograph. And I put it inside and say, you know, we as actors, you know, those gunfighters had nothing over us as far as challenges go. We're always challenged as actors, and he loved it. So that was like 1976, I guess. 3-4 months ago, I'm doing a Zoom for a friend of mine who's a photographer. And the girl there says, oh, by the way, I think it was Charlie's daughter or Charlie's niece. She says, you know, Charlie Bronson was my uncle. I don't remember what she said. And I said, oh, really? She said, yes. And that brown cowboy book from Time Life that you gave him back in 1976 was one of his pride, it makes me cry, was one of his pride possessions. And I have it. He left it to me. And I'm doing this Zoom with this girl talking about tenacity, things you and I talked about. And I started to cry. I just, you know, Charlie Bronson's favorite show was Cagney and Lacey. You go figure that one. You know, here's a guy who's got so much action. I bumped into him probably 1989, you know, 13 years after we did the movie. I said, Charlie, you remember me from White Buffalo? He says, yeah, I remember you. You're still doing that series with them girl. I said, wow, you mean Cagney and Lacey? He says, yeah, it's my favorite show. Go figure that out. Charles Bronson's favorite show is about two women who do no action whatsoever, but the show is great. You know, it's all very well done show. Probably should be on now with having an easier time than it did in 1982. You know,
it's a great show. And, you know, one thing you talk about, I was listening to an interview you did recently this week and talking about, you know, having tenacity. You have to have that in performing, but there's a special layer of tenacity for women, you know, because being, you said that men have to be tough with hearing no, But women have to be tougher with hearing it, and they're judged harsher. And so, you know, hearing you really advocate for women and what they go through is an amazing thing, and not something you always hear about from what I would consider classic Hollywood and being those heroes. So thank you for being a hero for women too, and advocating for the challenges they have in this industry.
Well, what was really funny was while I was making Cagney and Lacey, you know, the character was a macho chauvinist, you know, didn't think there was a place for women on the police force. Deep down inside, my mother was much more dominant than my father in the house. And I grew up with it. My mother, very kind person, self-sacrificing, but much more domineering than my father. And I always felt, for the 6 years I did that show, contrary to Victor is Becky, the character's name, I always felt that a woman could do everything a man could do. I always felt that. I never could really share that in the press very much, you know, because people like to believe, you know, you're the character, you know. But I've always felt that. And it's not even a matter of championing for me. You know, it's a matter that, you know, it's just that you choose the best person for the job. Doesn't matter if it's a female, a male. Doesn't matter if it's a 12-year-old. You know, you choose the best person. In Hollywood, there's 20 people waiting behind you to take your job in a second. So you better be good at what you do, whether you're a, you know, whether you're a child who hasn't graduated high school or you're a Rhodes Scholar. It doesn't matter, you know. So I think, you know, John Kreese also likes, in the show, female warriors. I've always liked, you know, I love tennis. Women that play tennis really stroke that ball. Bam. You know, there was a couple of players that just hit so hard. And I love watching that, you know, so healthy for the game. And same thing with female warriors. When Ralph's wife walks into my dojo and slaps me on the face, you know, and she ain't really nailed me. She couldn't get it right, and she couldn't get the rhythm going. So I finally told her, "All right, darling, just hit me." So she open hand, bam, you know, right across. But it was great for the moment.
You know? It didn't hurt.
Didn't hurt that much. But you know, and I wanted to, I wanted to laugh after that, but the writer said, "No, you can't laugh. It looks too lascivious."
You know?
So I just kind of like, you know, do a little smirk, and she left. But it was a great scene, you know, and that was so much part of the essence of the Cobra Kai character.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, you know, what it's like to transition a character through 40 years, what it's like to advocate for that character having more vulnerability and showing up more human. Thank you for talking about filming in Florida and the bonus of that and sharing these stories with us. It's been so wonderful having you here on the Dunedin Film Festival podcast. And thank you for being here. And that's a wrap on another episode of the Dunedin Film Festival podcast. We hope today's conversation has given you a behind-the-scenes glimpse into the world of film and the vibrant community of Dunedin that makes the festival so unique. If you enjoyed today's episode and want to keep the conversation going, please share it with anyone that you think would appreciate the stories that we're bringing to light. Word of mouth is the best way to help us grow and to continue to bring you fascinating insights from the heart of the film industry and beyond. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Diff Podcast for the latest updates, behind-the-scenes content, and a sneak peek at our upcoming guests. Your support means the world to us and helps keep the magic of film alive in Florida. Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep the reels rolling and the stories flowing. This has been the Dunedin Film Festival podcast. See you at the movies. Thank you for tuning in to the Dunedin Film Festival podcast, a product of Dunedin Film Festival, Inc., a 501c3 nonprofit facilitating the development of Florida's Culture Corridor in Pinellas County.